That week there was a meeting at Giancarlo Tononi's villa of the Order of the Oriental Temple, Free and Accepted Masons. Present as an honored guest was Sir John Babcock, a member of the Scotch Rite Freemasons in England. Sir John, having decided that the Fire and Water Sonata was a Masonic initiation set to music, was not surprised to see C.G.'s Mundo Celline among the Neapolitan Freemasons. He was a bit startled, however, by the inadvertent hostility in C.G.'s Mundo's glance, which was not quite successfully hidden by a pretense of cordiality. Of course, Sir John thought, he has seen me with Maria and is jealous. He must have courted her unsuccessfully once, or tried to. After the usual preliminaries, everybody adjourned to Tononi's dining room for antipasto and abundant wine. Pietro Malatesta began by discussing the reforms of the Empress Catherine in Russia. Everybody says she is a whore, the other Englishman present, Robert Francis Drake, commented. People always spread such scandal about a strong-minded woman, Pietro said. The fact is that Russia has had religious freedom for almost 3 years now. I very much fear that we can no longer consider Russia the most backward nation on earth. Would anybody care to guess which is the most backward? An elderly priest, who was named Ratti, if Sir John had caught that correctly, spoke up. I know where you are leading us, Brother Pietro. Another expedition to Roma to argue for relaxation of the Inquisition, no? Not at all, Pietro Malatesta said. We have tried that often enough. I think it is time that we become braver. I suggest an expedition to the Holy Father to argue for total abolition of the Inquisition. Excellent, Giancarlo Tononi said. And next, let us build a ladder to the moon and teach our donkeys to fly. It has already happened in Tuscany and Parma, Pietro said stubbornly. It is possible. Tuscany and Parma are not Napoli, Father Ratti said. I am willing to join in this effort because only by such repeated attempts will we achieve our goals. But I am not optimistic. Right now, as you must know, our new pope, Clement XIV, is being besieged by cardinals who wish to strengthen the Inquisition. They also want to abolish the Jesuits, he added darkly. I say, Sir John interjected, why is there so much prejudice against the Society of Jesus in Catholic countries lately? There has been aroused a suspicion, Father Ratti said briefly, that many of us are Freemasons. Perish the thought. You see, Brother John, Pietro Malatesta commented, in Parma, they not only abolished the Inquisition, but also expelled the Jesuits. That may sound paradoxical, but it is simply rising anti-clericalism in the north. The Duke of Parma does not like either Dominican conservatives or Jesuit liberals. He wants priests out of politics completely. In this climate of conflict, Sigismundo Celline said, the new pope may move in any direction. I say Uncle Pietro is right. We have nothing to lose by petitioning for abolition of the Inquisition. The matter was put to a vote. It was decided that Father Ratti, Count Maldonado, and 5 others would go to Roma to speak to the pope personally. The next issue was raised by Giancarlo Tononi. It had been a long time since anybody had seen the Carbonari, he said. Perhaps worry about the Inquisition had made us all too cautious. You are, as always, subtle as a rhinoceros, Robert Francis Drake said. Who is it this time? Tononi told of a fisherman recently lost at sea. His wife, she does the best she can, but there are many children. Pietro Malatesta took a coin bag from his cloak and emptied half of it on the table. In a few minutes, everybody had followed suit, and a stack of lire was being passed to Tononi. I haven't been out in blackface for a long time, he said. It will be fun. For the widow's son, Count Maldonado said solemnly. For the widow's son, all chorused. Sigismundo blushed, thinking of his wrong guess, during his first initiation, that the widow's son was Parsifal. Now that he knew the answer, it seemed that he should have guessed long ago. It was in the Bible after all. Robert Francis Drake then took the floor. There were always wild rumors about Masons, he said, and it must be so. As long as we must act in secrecy, as long as Europe is an armed madhouse. Nonetheless, one rumor was more and more prevalent, because there was an occasional truth in it. In some places, he said, sodomites have formed Masonic lodges as a cover for their, real purpose in getting together, and when such things are discovered, all Masonry receives the same brand. What are you proposing? Father Ratti asked. Grand Inspector General is virtually an honorary title these days, Drake said. I think it should be more than honorary. We should uncover such lodges before the outer world does and expel them to avoid the scandal that ensues if they were uncovered by others. That sounds like a good idea on the surface, Pietro Malatesta said, but I do not like the implications. We are an odd bunch of birds, if you ask me, to propose in one breath that the church end its inquisition and then, in the next breath, to start an inquisition of our own. Old Abraham Orfali spoke up. Spies we do not need. Better we have 100 sodomites than one spy. Exactly, Sir John Babcock said. Sodomy is a dreadful and revolting vice, but when men are asked to inform on each other, malice comes to the surface, false charges are made, and we end up with our own inquisition, as Brother Pietro said. Well, Tanone said, I think we have exhausted the subject of sodomy for a while. Anybody want to pursue it further? I thought not. Brother Babcock, as an honored visitor, what can you tell this lodge about the working of the craft in your own country? Sir John said, I believe some of you know of John Wilkes? He was in Napoli a while back, Pietro Malatesta said. A great wit and raconteur and a brother in the craft. Some of our brothers, however, do not understand the full ramifications of his case, so you'd better explain. John Wilkes, Babcock said, has been expelled from Parliament 3 times now. He had been expelled only twice when I was in England, Sigismundo Cellini said. He was declared an outlaw after the second expulsion, Babcock explained. This year, he finally returned and risked imprisonment. The king's party was quick to oblige him, and he is still in jail tonight. Meanwhile, the voters have elected him to Parliament again, even while he sits in prison, and the Parliament has expelled him again. What are the issues involved? Tanone asked. The original issue was freedom of the press, Babcock said. Wilkes was expelled the first time for publishing a criticism of the king that was deemed libelous by a judge of the king's party. But after the expulsion, the issue became the right of the voters to be represented by the man they chose. 17 counties have petitioned the king to let Wilkes sit in Parliament, where the voters want him. The king turns a deaf ear. We of the craft have formed an organization, the Society of Supporters of the Bill of Rights. Our original intent was merely to agitate for the legal return of Wilkes to Parliament, but once we started our ball rolling, we found many allies from odd quarters. The Society of Supporters has become more radical than we planned. It has demanded the whole Parliament be dissolved as not representing the people, and a new Parliament be elected to replace it. It has also demanded universal adult suffrage. You mean, Count Maldonado asked, that every adult could vote, even the peasants? Exactly, everybody. Well, except the women, that will probably be the next demand. We are moving rapidly toward a new age. The world is on fire, Sigismundo Cellini said quietly. A similar meeting was held later that week in Bordeaux, France, but the ideas of those present were somewhat different from those of the Neapolitan Lodge. Louis-Philippe, Duke of Chartres, representing the Social Contract Lodge, was officially in charge as the highest-ranking Freemason present. Philippe, who was the richest man in France, would have dominated the meeting even without his 32nd degree initiation. As the leading supporter of liberal causes among the nobles, he had already won the admiration of the nation. His well-publicized charities had also endeared him to millions. Only a few suspected that behind all his deeds, he had one goal in mind: to become King Philippe, benevolent despot, after the present king had been good enough to die a natural death, and a few others in succession were removed. As Duke of Chartres, Philippe was next in line to become Duke of Orléans. With proper management, he could move from there to king in a few steps, if all went according to plan. The men in the room understood and supported this goal. Only one of them thus far had considered the possibility of accelerating the process by persuading King Louis XV to die sooner than nature intended. The overt atheism in the Paris lodges has to stop, Philippe was arguing. It may guarantee that every new member is a liberal, I'll grant you, but at what cost, gentlemen? We drive away thousands of possible recruits every day with that policy. I quite agree, said Count Casanova, who was the only man at the meeting dressed more expensively than Philippe. No man can understand the world or understand how power is actually grasped and used until he has mastered the principles of Machiavelli and Hobbes. Everything is ultimately settled by strength and stealth. But it is stupidity in extremis to proclaim such views openly. Such ideas are only for those whose intelligence has qualified them for the higher degrees in the craft. Exactly, said the guest from Bavaria, a fat lawyer named Hans Zeusser. Admit everyone who wants to be a Mason. Challenge their false ideas and superstitions gradually, as they proceed from grade to grade. We are all of one mind about that, said Count Cagliostro. The question is, what do we do about it? I hardly imagine we can persuade the fanatics in Paris to come around to our way of thinking. Philippe was ready for that challenge. His answer seemed so brilliant to him, in fact, that he had quite forgotten it had been suggested to him earlier that day during a long talk with Cagliostro. Philippe had even forgotten how drowsy he had become during one part of that talk. This is what we should do, Philippe said. We must form a completely new order, a bigger one than has ever existed before. It should be the best financed Masonic order in the world, and I will undertake to finance its rapid growth personally. I think it would be wise if I were also its Grand Master, since my close family tie to the king will be advantageous in lending prestige and preventing suspicions of subversion. That is an excellent idea, Cagliostro said smoothly. You are indeed far thinking. When this new order becomes large enough, everybody will regard it as the only Masonic group that is really important. What about the Illuminati in Avignon? Asked Casanova. Are they really Alumbrados? No, they were founded by an alchemist named Pernetti, Philippe said. I have had several meetings with them. They will pose no problems. Their heads are all lost in a maze of Kabbalah and Rosicrucianism and other mystic hogwash, very much like the Italian Masons, I might say. If our new order has the proper mystical trappings on the surface, they will accept us, as long as we keep the secrets of the higher degrees from reaching their ears. I have been an alchemist myself, Casanova said quietly. The mysteries of that art, I assure you, are not incompatible with our own goals. Of course, Cagliostro said softly. Et ego in Arcadia, eh? He and Casanova exchanged cryptic looks. Sometimes I don't know what you two are talking about, Philippe complained. Sometimes, Zeusser protested, I never understand them. I know only that they have the same motives as the rest of us, the destruction of the Inquisition and the popes. And a better king for France, Cagliostro added blandly. Casanova observed Philippe's smug smile. How easily that man swallows flattery, he thought, and how skillfully Cagliostro feeds it to him, snug and cozy as two jackals at dinner. An illuminated monarch, Cagliostro added. He really pours on the oil, Casanova thought. What is the news from Bavaria? Philippe asked, changing the subject. Things are the same as ever, Zeusser said glumly. We are, as always, more priest-ridden than the Papal States or even the benighted kingdom of Napoli. We have one new recruit, however, who fills me with admiration, and I expect great things from him. He is a Jesuit named Father Weishaupt. We have too many Jesuits already, Casanova said somewhat hotly. We might end up someday with them running international masonry. Or, Cagliostro said smoothly, we may end up someday with us running the Society of Jesus. It depends on who has studied Machiavelli more assiduously. Weishaupt has a plan, Zeusser said, to form a secret society within the Jesuit order and another within Bavarian masonry and create a union that neither side fully understands. When the tail wags, Casanova interjected ironically, how will we know which is the tail and which is the dog? Weishaupt will be between the tail and the dog, Zeusser said, a bit excitedly. Everybody laughed. Excuse us, Cagliostro said, recovering first. That was an extraordinary metaphor. It seems to situate Father Weishaupt in the vicinity of the dog's arse. The time will come, Zeusser said, when none of you will laugh at Adam Weishaupt. Maybe, Casanova thought, but it will be a long time before I hear that name without thinking of a dog's rump. Such is the power of metaphor. The subject of Father Weishaupt was soon dropped, and plans for the Masonic order were discussed at length. Somehow, they all arrived at the conclusion that it should have the name proposed by Count Cagliostro, the Grand Orient Lodge of Egyptian Freemasonry. When the meeting finally adjourned, Casanova returned to his hotel wondering a great deal about Count Cagliostro. Nobody had heard of him a year ago, and now he was already in the highest ranks of Freemasonry. That the man was not a count was obvious, and Casanova was no more deceived on that point than one card sharp by another. Cagliostro had the complexion and the accent of Sicilian peasantry, even if he had acquired the outer trappings of the French aristocracy. Casanova had the eerie feeling that he had seen this man a long time ago in Italy. Somehow he knew that was a false memory. He had some link with Cagliostro somewhere, but he could not quite remember it. Maybe I met his father, he thought, or his brother. One thing was obvious. Cagliostro, whomever and whatever he was, knew as much about magnetism as Mesmer. He already had Philippe under his influence, and Philippe did not even remember the times he had stared into a candle or counted backward or obeyed whatever technique Cagliostro had used. Casanova had learned to recognize the state. Philippe was under mental suggestion, and the memory of the process had been erased. The man who would be king, Casanova thought, under the control of a Sicilian adventurer, cute as a grave robber's grin. The Grand Orient Lodge would have a lively career, he thought. This Cagliostro obviously came out of one of the more occult and witchy Italian lodges. Perhaps, Casanova thought, he had been involved with a Strege once. Maybe that's where he learned magnetism. But, damn it, why do I feel I've seen those violet Sicilian eyes somewhere before? Sigismundo Cellini was blocked. The sonata was just not coming to the right conclusion. Usually, he knew what the end would be like long before he arrived there. The end was always implicit in the beginning, in a certain sense, but this time he had gotten himself lost in a forest of counterpoint and elaboration. Patience, he told himself. Sometimes the creative process has to be allowed to happen of its own nature. Trying to force it can just lead to frustration. It was night, and the whole house was asleep. Sigismundo suddenly knew what was going to happen. After getting out of the maison in Paris without the pox, he had sternly avoided brothels and remained true to the ideal of Maria in his mind. But he had discovered that it was necessary, absolutely necessary, to relieve the tension occasionally. Have to get into my nightshirt, he thought. It isn't harmful except in excess, and I am most careful, almost ascetic. I do it only when absolutely necessary. With his eyes closed, Maria became more real. She was as solid as the four angels Abraham invoked, and then it was like music, carrying him out of himself, going deeper and deeper and deeper into visions of beauty, and the whole Tempio Malatesta came back to him. And then he saw Isciotta degli Atti and the gold and jeweled mosaics, as he walked through the Tempio with a great music of Telemann and Scarlatti and J.C. Bach and J.S. Bach were being played. It was like floating above Napoli during his first initiation, and Maria became shameless and wanton, urging him on, telling him she loved him. He was all over her, every part of her, kissing eyes and nipples and belly, cunt and toes and all of her, throat and thighs and knees, and all of her, going deeper and deeper into the music, thinking that this was just what he felt when a composition began to take form. The same intense centering on the one act, the same joy. The Dominicans were crazy, he was sure of it. This was like art and the fourth soul and creativity and all he dreamed of and longed for. He stopped and got a handkerchief. The church said that the first entry of sin into the soul came with a plausible lie. It was no lie that this was like art and initiation and the fourth soul. If this was sin, all art and beauty was sin too. No. The church was crazy. He went on and on, circling back, pausing, waiting, building the suspense, just as in a sonata, reaching further and further toward the essence of joy and beauty, and Maria encouraged him and inspired him. He was panting, and his heart was beating wildly at the climax. He lay back on the bed, exhausted, thinking that the letter ship was like a pyramid, and soon he would understand the symbolism of the pyramid. Ship transformed Jehovah into Yeshua, divinity into flesh, and the conclusion of the sonata came back to him in a flash. He wrote the last bars in a flush of excitement. Strange that the sin, as the church called it, had unleashed his creativity. He would have to think about that. Now, however, with the music finished, he would definitely try to sleep. Suddenly he understood the Masonic pyramid, because he was within the pyramid. An idea that had almost been clear to him in England 4 years ago now came back with a second flush of creative excitement. He sketched it quickly. And by the next day, he had finished drawings of his machine to show everybody at the university. It would move from place to place, unlike the machines that stood in factories to do their work. You could actually use this to travel in. It had a steam engine based on that of James Watt, and it had three wheels, since three points determine a plane, and he called it an autokineton, from the Greek roots for self and mover. Father Pacelli, Sigismundo's professor of calculus, was most impressed, although also very dubious. "You really think people could travel in this without being made ill by the motion?" "Undoubtedly," Sigismundo said. "It could travel just like a horse-drawn coach, but faster. People could cross Europe in hours instead of days." "If it works," Father Pacelli said. The student body as a whole was less tolerant. Sigismundo was teased and ridiculed for days, and finally a satire on his device appeared on the bulletin board. The parody machine was called an ipsimobile, the Latin equivalent of autokineton. It had five wheels instead of three and ran on moonbeams. Sigismundo was by then convinced the construction of his device was possible, and, with advances in chemistry and mechanics, someday inevitable. He took the sketches to Father Ratti's friend, Father Marconani, of the Department of Natural Philosophy. Old Marconani studied the sketches with considerable bemusement. "No horses," he muttered, comparing the side and top views. "Runs by itself. Autokineton, you say? Very ingenious, yes, upon my word." Sigismundo waited. "As this is designed," Marconani said finally, "it would require a quite large waterfall to power it, and I do not see how you could transport the waterfall around with you." Sigismundo explained, "With the proper chemical reactions, you could get the same power effect as you could get from a waterfall." "Yes, yes indeed," the old priest said. "Most clever. Do you have any idea of what chemical reactions you would need to produce that result?" "Well," Sigismundo said, "I'm still working on that." The old man looked at him somberly for a moment. "They tell me you are a musician," he said. "That is a minority opinion," Sigismundo replied. "I write music, much music, but people say it is strange and unmelodic. I sometimes fear that it is a crazy hobby and not my true talent at all, but I do not know what my true talent is." "Well, as for that," Marconani said, "you have a true scientific aptitude. If you keep working along these lines, something practical will emerge eventually, perhaps as a side product. This contraption may be 100 years ahead of its time, but it certainly shows an ingenious mechanical mind." The day Maria Maldonado married Sir John Babcock, Sigismundo Cellini went out and got roaring drunk. But Maria did not know about that at the time. Even if she had known, she would not have considered it a serious matter. She was too happy to believe there were any serious problems anywhere. Maria had fallen in love with Sir John gradually, not at all in the manner of the passionate heroines of novels. She realized that he was likable, intelligent, and different from most other men in some way she could not define, except that he had a rare understanding of her feminine view of the world. Sir John did not consider it odd that she had intellectual interests. "I could not be in love with someone who did not share my concern with such matters," he said once. That he had some terrible tragedy in his past, Maria became sure of, as she knew him better. This was not, as she first suspected, something she was imagining, because heroes in novels always had such melodramatic secrets. She could read it in his occasional flashes of bitterness and cynicism, and in the sorrow that came over his face sometimes when he looked at young boys. He was remembering something that had happened when he was a boy, Maria knew. Thinking about being married to him, thinking about kissing and caressing him, and, of course, about the sexual act, she began to realize more and more how such images could excite her as well as frighten her. Well, That was what Mother Ursula had told her. Women can feel passions as intensely as men. The belief that nice girls did not feel such things was a myth created by Dominicans and other ignorant males. What is it really like? Maria had dared to ask the abbess once. At its best, Mother Ursula said, it can be almost as wonderful as prayer. Maria knew that the abbess was not talking about ordinary prayer, the way most people mumbled Pater Nosters and Ave Marias. Mother Ursula meant the special kind of focus, the special concentration on God, which brought the healing power into her hands, for instance, and perhaps gave her other qualities that were not so spectacular, but were equally unusual, such as her unfailing good humor and optimism in a world where most people were worried and anxious or full of anger at least half of their waking hours. Maria was capable of that kind of prayer, but only rarely. Mother Ursula lived in that illuminated focus as a normal state. Mother Ursula also said that to think about sexual things was perfectly normal as you approached the marrying age. The doctrine that such thoughts were sinful, she said, resulted from the ignorance of certain theologians. Jesus had made a joke about that once, she explained, but theologians could not imagine that he had a sense of humor, so they took him literally. So the more Maria thought of Sir John, the more she found herself unwillingly, and then half-willingly, fantasizing about kissing and caressing and doing the other with him. And she was always a bit worried about such fantasies because, despite Mother Ursula, the rest of the church taught that such thoughts were decidedly sinful, and in the conflict between sensuality and guilt, she began to realize that her attraction to him was not merely sexual but affectionate, and not merely affectionate but passionate. She was in love. And being in love was just as wonderful as the novel said. They had not exaggerated that at all. It was just like the first time she had felt the power in her hands and healed the peasant. It was as if the whole orchestra from the Teatro San Carlo were following her around and playing the Hallelujah chorus continually. It was so wonderful that at times she even felt out of touch with ordinary life and seemed to be walking around in a trance. She began to understand that loopy Cellini fellow and, for the first time, felt a little sorry for him. In ordinary life, when somebody walked into a room, you were either mildly happy if you liked them, or mildly annoyed if you didn't like them. Being in love was hardly noticing when somebody came into the room, even if they were riding a giraffe and singing Basso Profundo, unless it was Sir John. And then, if it was Sir John, Maria would still hardly notice the giraffe. More and more often, the mere sight of Sir John would excite her. Maria would feel a heat and a pleasure in the place she had learned never to touch, the place where birth happened, and she would even have wild thoughts about escaping from the chaperones and giving herself to him at once, without waiting for marriage or even a proposal of marriage. Being in love was listening intently to everything he said, wanting passionately to share all of his thoughts on every possible subject, and it was also telling him everything, holding nothing back, even talking about the healing power that she dared not discuss with any Neapolitan, lest word get back to the Inquisition. Telling him all she thought, all she hoped, all she feared, and, best of all, it was never worrying that the stream of confidences would bore him or embarrass him because he was in love with her, too. Sir John was not astonished or incredulous about the healing power. "There is a man in France now," he said, "who is trying to educate the doctors about this. Franz Anton Mesmer, he's called. I have never in my life heard so many charges of quackery and charlatanism directed at one lone individual, nor have I heard such intemperate and bigoted language from men who are allegedly trying to be objective scientists. The fact remains, despite all the denunciations, that Mesmer had performed many remarkable cures, witnessed by persons of high repute." "Mesmer is just in the wrong place," Maria said. "The French are all atheists these days." She said it sadly, as if pronouncing that the whole nation had leprosy. "Mesmer does not claim that his power comes from God directly," Sir John said cautiously. "He claims it is a magnetism between living beings, like the magnetism between metals." "Then Mesmer is a fool, too," Maria said. "The power works only when you go away and let God come into you." Sir John paused a moment. "That is the way it works for you," he said finally. I have an uncle who has seen similar things in India. The yogins, which is the name for people who can do such things, say the power is in the spinal column for everybody. They assert that if you do the proper contortions, the power will come up the spine into the brain. They call it Kundalini. Perhaps it works the same whether we think of it theologically like you, or anatomically like the yogins, or magnetically like Mesmer. You are not sure what you believe, Maria said sadly. Such uncertainty seemed to her perilously close to French atheism. Yes, Sir John said wearily, with a strange, crooked grin. I do not know what to believe. I have read too much and traveled too far. Certitude belongs to those who have only lived in a place where everybody believes the same things. Sir John then started reminiscing about some of the strange things he had seen in his travels. In North Africa, he said, there were groups called Sufis, a word that meant nothing in Arabic or in any other tongue. They could stab themselves with swords without bleeding. He had seen it, and he had heard even stranger tales about them from men of good repute. The Sufis attributed their gift to a power called Baraka, which they said permeates the whole universe, even the parts we call empty space. In France, he had seen a mountebank who called himself Count Cagliostro, and this man was at least three-quarters pure humbug, but he could make people see and hear astounding things, as if they were traveling to other worlds. In Hamburg, he had seen a man claiming to be the legendary Frankenstein, who could seemingly read minds. A short, squat, blonde man he was, totally unimpressive to look at, but he could tell you things about yourself you thought nobody knew. There was another man who claimed to be Frankenstein, Maria puzzled, who came to Napoli a few years ago. I didn't see him, but everybody was talking about him for months and months. But he wasn't short and blonde, he was tall and dark. That is why I make a principle of uncertainty, Sir John said, smiling. One never knows in this wicked world what is real and what is somebody's masquerade. It was only after 2 months of chaperonage that they were occasionally left alone for intervals of up to 10 minutes, and it was at such times these mystifying subjects were discussed. It was only after 2 more months that they were left alone long enough for Sir John to take the risk of putting his arm around her. One kiss, he said, looking deep into her eyes, just one. Maria could not help smiling. I thought you'd never ask, she said gaily. The kiss lasted a great deal longer than she had expected, and she knew that she was encouraging him to continue. It was perhaps not quite as wonderful as that special kind of prayer that brought the healing power, but it was at least as wonderful as Mr. Handel's hallelujahs. Then she felt his penis becoming hard. My God, she thought, that's what novelists mean when they write, she felt his masculinity hard against her. Why can't they tell us in plain words so we know what to expect? She pulled away, suddenly nervous. They stared at each other like two strangers meeting in an empty castle at midnight. She knew she was blushing, and Sir John seemed pale. I love you, he said with a strange emphasis, as if he could hardly believe it himself. Maria, he said, I... What is it? She exclaimed. I want to marry you, he said. I... Then he was weeping. Maria believed that Englishmen never wept, just as elephants never fly and Sicilians never forgive an insult. But Sir John had not only forgotten to kneel in the ritual manner when proposing, he was so overcome that he was crying like a child. Maria threw herself into his arms again. She didn't understand this at all, but she knew he needed to be held. She noticed that his penis was no longer hard. That had vanished in the explosion of emotion. She kissed the tears on his cheeks, murmuring endearments. He held her fiercely, almost frantically. I love you, he repeated. I want to marry you. I have been alone so long. This had something to do with the tragedy he never discussed. She could guess that much. What is it? She asked gently. You can tell me, caro mio. Sir John laughed and groaned at once. They had been speaking English ever since he first said, I love you, in that language. Caro mio, he repeated. That is far lovelier than any endearment in my language. You must always call me that. He removed her arms and began pacing. I want to marry you, he repeated. Am I acceptable? Si. Yes, caro mio, darling. I was in love once before, he said, avoiding her eyes. The woman died tragically. I felt nothing at the time. I didn't realize that was shock. I thought I was an emotionless monster. I hated myself. Then, when the grief came finally, something had changed in me. I have never been in love since then. Let me finish. Maria, who had been about to interrupt, nodded. I have told you that my father was a judge. He had a passion for the law, for justice, I should say. That has been my passion, too. He taught it to me. It is my intent to enter Parliament, to work for the causes I believe in. It was conveyed to me by men in important places that a family man is much more acceptable to the electors than a bookish and somewhat reclusive bachelor. I have been searching for 2 years, according to my own notions of honor, to find some woman wise enough and tolerant enough to live with an old duck like me. I expected an ordinary marriage of convenience. I did not expect to fall in love again. He stopped. For a moment she thought he was on the edge of tears again. I have to tell you these things, he went on. I do not fall in love easily. I think I am, perhaps, more passionate about ideas and ideals than about human beings. I want you, Maria, but I must warn you against myself. I do not know what I am. You are a good man, she said at once, an intelligent man. You should not have such doubts about yourself. He looked at her queerly. Have you ever seen a man cry before? Yes. When Mama died, Papa cried. I have believed that nobody could respect a man who showed such weakness. You are human. That is a weakness? Sir John sighed. It is so bleeding complicated, he said vaguely. I would rather blow my brains out with a pistol than think I am going to ruin your life. You are not as eccentric as you think, Maria said firmly. You have been alone too long, that's all. You are kind and often very funny, and I love you. Count Maldonado received the news the following morning with evident pleasure. He enthusiastically hugged Sir John and kissed Maria. They had to shout because the Count was having breakfast in the garden, and Carlo was engaging in his daily target practice at the other end of the grounds. There is one problem, the Count shouted. Are you willing to convert to Catholicism? Bang, went a pistol. If it were necessary to win Maria, Sir John shouted, I would convert to Mohammedism. That is most romantic, the Count shouted, but it is not the proper attitude to express when we talk to the bishop. However, considering the political situation in England, I suggest that you get married again, in the Anglican communion, when you return there. Otherwise you will eventually be accused of being a Jacobite and your career will be ruined. Bang, Carlo fired again. I will not convert to this Anglicanism, Maria shouted fiercely. That will not be necessary, Count Maldonado shouted. It is still possible for an English statesman to have a Catholic wife, is it not, Sir John? Bang! Most certainly, Sir John shouted. Everybody knows Edmund Burke's wife is a Catholic. The Tories bring that up at every election. But the electors continue to return him to Parliament. So then, the Count shouted, as a minimum courtesy to our respective realms, 2 weddings are advisable. But after that, you can certainly remain Catholic, Maria, and you can remain Anglican, Sir John. Some fanatics of both sects will not like it, but most people will be mollified. The Count smiled. And I hope I will have a grandson by this time next year, he shouted. And to please an old man, I hope you will spend part of each year here in Napoli, especially when my grandson is young. Sir John smiled in turn. You are giving me your greatest treasure, he shouted. When my political career allows it, Maria and I will spend 1 or 2 months here every year. Go away, the two of you, the Count shouted, before I cry. Bang, Carlo fired again. The next days went by like a dream for Maria. The banns were published by the cathedral. Papa was in conference continually with the bishop about the details of the mass and reception. Everybody of status in Napoli was dropping by the villa to congratulate the family and to look over Sir John. Sir John remained polite and unruffled under all the scrutiny. He was taking lessons in Catholicism from Father Ratti of the Sacred Heart College, and both of them seemed aware that Sir John was not going to become an Orthodox Roman Catholic and had not been an Orthodox Anglican Catholic for many years, but that he would go through the forms with due solemnity. Sir John rebelled against Neapolitan protocol only once, when the doctor came to examine Maria. "That practice is barbaric," he told Count Maldonado heatedly. "It is worse. It is hypocritical," the old man said calmly. "Doctors are notoriously easy to bribe on matters of this sort." "Well, then," Sir John exclaimed, "why not just ignore the whole hideous business?" "Because," the Count said, "it would be known. Believe me, I know Napoli. People would talk for years to come about how I swindled the naive Englishman and sold him damaged goods. That would be cruel to Maria and eventually to your children." "Ah," Sir John said, making a noise of revulsion, "it is gross." But when this was reported to Maria, she decreed that normal Neapolitan practice would be followed. Dr. Mazzini had examined her twice before, on occasions when premenstrual tension had caused her to worry. She had learned to relax and not be nervous during Mazzini's myopic probings. And so Sir John received a signed document testifying that his bride-to-be was intatta. As soon as the doctor left, Sir John managed to have a few moments alone with Maria in the garden. He showed her the certificate and then placed it in the trash bin and burned it. "I loathe having you treated as merchandise," he said hotly. "You should not be stamped and approved by government inspectors." How very English, Maria thought. "It was necessary," she said simply, "like your lessons in faith from Father Ratti. Being forced to submit to such a thing was an offense against you. Don't you realize that?" "Caro mio," Maria said, "I'm too happy these days to notice offenses." Sir John smiled. "When you call me that, I do not notice offenses either. Say it again. Caro mio." And so that matter was passed over. But Maria later found herself thinking that nobody had asked for Sir John's virginity to be attested. Aside from the fact that it was physically impossible in the case of the male, it would be regarded as damned impudent. Mother Ursula was right. To a great extent, marriage was a property relationship, with a woman as the property. But in this case, such social rules did not apply. Sir John's sense of justice extended even to women and black people. He was against slavery. He would not treat her like property. He worried, for some strange reason, that he might be inadequate. He was that sort of man, always making more demands on himself than on others. Many English, especially the wealthy ones, if they were Whigs, were like that. Sir John had told her once that it was a mental set created by schools like Eton. The training device, he said, was an ordinary walking stick or cane. That was why, he explained, you'll never hear one upperclassman Englishman overtly insult another. An insult, when necessary, is delivered, he said, as an innocuous remark about the furniture, say, and is always accompanied by a bland smile. The man insulted always replies with an equally bland smile, and an equally quiet remark about, perhaps, the latest Irish rebellion. Another Englishman can understand exactly what is being conveyed, but it is most confusing to foreigners. You will live among us for some years before you can decipher such conversations. The first man is really saying, I see no new furniture, and I deduce that your business is not doing too well since everybody discovered you are a scoundrel. And the second man is replying, and you may be in debtor's prison soon if the Irish burn down the rest of your estates. You see, cara mia, the difference between self-discipline, self-restraint, and sheer hypocrisy is always in danger of being blurred among us. The happy result is that there are few liars among us, since lying is scarcely necessary when no conversation means what it seems to say. Maria realized that she had considered English novels dull because she had never understood the nuances of well-bred English speech. Those novels might be what she had been told they were, very witty, once you comprehended that the characters were never saying what they really meant. But Sir John, alone in his room one night, stared at himself in the mirror for a long time. It doesn't show in my face, he thought. That is just superstition, and I have stopped, almost stopped, for nearly 2 years, with only a few relapses. I can stop entirely, I can. He took out his journal and began writing, deliberately adopting the style of his favorite French aphorist, trying to detach and observe his own mental state. The lonely man, distrustful of himself, can find solace in taking sides against himself. To think that the world is right and I am wrong, That is the courage of solitary doubt, and yet it is also the way to one's true self, the essence that can be found only when vanity is rejected as the shabby, flattering beggar it is. There is something for which we do not have a name, something that will not allow us to lie to it. It instantly punishes every evasion, every weakness. It will not allow us to escape our burdens because it wishes to make us stronger for greater burdens. Being haunted by this demon is the situation of the initiate, the elect. Only inner warfare of this sort causes us to descend to the bottom of things and put away all easy answers, even philosophy, even profundity. Then, at the bottom of the pit that has no bottom, we may look the tyrant in the eye and know who he is, who destiny is, and what he wants of us. This does not make us better at all. It makes us twin brothers to necessity. Sir John stopped writing, slumped back in his chair. Words, 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 as Hamlet said. Analysis is an even better disguise than cheerfulness. He remembered the nickname Better Logic Babcock from the years at Eton. Can you tell us the exact time, T, they used to ask him, when A becomes not A? Oh, I could tell you a great deal about that, he answered them in retrospect. I look at Maria, and I am A, as I was with Bertha in Heidelberg. Then a boy with a certain brutal beauty passes on the street, and I am not A again. And yes, I can even tell you the exact instant, T. Which was more true, time or numbers? The boys had been casual, clandestine, hidden. The affairs with women had lasted longer, because he had not had to sneak and hide then. So, in terms of time, he was about 50% A and 50% not A, and in terms of actual partners, less than 20% A and more than 80% not A. Either way, a pretty problem for the strict Aristotelians. I am the intermediate term, he thought, more of an affront to logic than to Christian theology. But there would be no more boys, he was determined. The tyrant, who might be destiny, had taught him that it was not important to have what you want. It is essential to want what you have. There was the House of Commons first, the House of Lords later, as a possibility. There would be a happy marriage, and no more horrors of either sex. He had almost thought he was in love with Bertha in Heidelberg. He knew he was in love with Maria. There would be no more boys, no risk of scandal. And yet, he knew he was anxious. He was avoiding the one thought that could seriously undermine his rationally planned decisions. Suppose you can't turn off one faucet without turning off the other. That would be a malign joke on the part of God or nature. Besides, he was sure it was not true. He was worrying himself unnecessarily. After all, he had gone months and months without boys. During the affair with Bertha, and turning off one faucet had not turned off the other. But for years and years? I know why they invented sin and why they have obscenity laws, he thought bitterly. It is so that we do not experiment enough, inquire enough to understand ourselves fully, so that we all live with doubts and misgivings. That is the edge they use to govern us. They literally have us by the balls. I love her. It will work. I must not worry about such nonsense. Being haunted by this demon, he thought, is like being midway between a god and a dumb sacrificial animal. He blew out the candle and tried to sleep. And so Maria was innocently happy, and Sir John was guardedly happy, and the wedding day finally arrived. And when Sir John stood in the great cathedral with the organ music swelling all around him, echoing from all the walls, he looked at Maria coming down the aisle on Count Maldonado's arm, with the five children in white carrying her train behind her, and he knew he would love her devoutly all his life. He was sure of it. At this moment, he loved her more than he had ever loved anyone, more than Geoffrey, who had drowned. Pietro Malatesta was a guest at the wedding, cementing again in public the new friendship between himself and Count Maldonado, the end of the 150-year-old Malatesta-Maldonado feud. At one point, Pietro glanced around and saw his nephew, Sigismundo Cellini, standing in the back in the shadows, trying to be unseen by anyone. The look on Sigismundo's face was unnerving. It reminded Pietro of the boy's true father, of Peppino Basalmo. Then Sigismundo turned abruptly and left. He'll probably get drunk and be himself again in the morning, Pietro thought. This is a happy day. I shouldn't ruin it with worry. And then the vows were taken, and the bishop said that Sir John could kiss Maria, and the organ music began to rise again. Maria was in his arms, and he suddenly felt that inexplicable rising of tears again. As they kissed, he was thinking, "It is done. I am no longer alone. I will deserve her love and trust. I will." When they broke from the kiss, he almost laughed, because he had a slight erection. Well, he thought, it isn't all that conspicuous, and the bishop has probably seen it before at other weddings. It's the organ music that does it, even more than the kiss. It's a crazy religion that uses the most erotic of all musical instruments at its sacred feasts, even while preaching against eroticism. Then Count Maldonado was kissing him on both cheeks, and a dozen men were shaking his hand. And then the organ was more erotic than ever. He could imagine what the Methodist would say of such a ceremony. Pure paganism disguised as Christianity. And then he and Maria were walking down the aisle to the nave, and there was the whole damn banquet and reception to get through. All he could think of was getting Maria's clothes off, initiating her into the sacrament of pleasure, rewarding her in every one of the dozen ways he knew, adoring her for taking away his loneliness. Sir John and Lady Babcock, he thought, we are now legally one person. The afternoon was interminable. Everybody had brought their huge families to the banquet, of course, and several children soon gorged themselves on the delicacies, becoming ill. Vomiting children do not create a passionate, romantic atmosphere, Sir John thought wryly, although they were perhaps a warning of what marriage was actually like. He and Maria could hardly exchange two words. If somebody wasn't telling him what a lucky man he was and banging him heartily on the back, some woman was hugging Maria and weeping. Pietro Malatesta, usually the coolest of men, got drunk and began doing what he considered a hilarious imitation of the bishop, although nobody else found it amusing until the climax, when he suddenly fell over with a crash right out of one of Walpole's Gothic castles. It took five men to carry him to the well and revive him. And then, somehow, finally, all that was over, and Sir John and Maria were in the carriage, on their way to the Count's country villa outside Maracchiaro, where they could spend their honeymoon. "Are you very tired, cara mia?" he asked. "Di tanto in tanto," she said, "but very happy. Oh, I love you, love you." They kissed again, with total abandon this time. It went on, and Maria felt as if she were bursting into 100 pieces, like one of the fireworks on a saint's day. Sir John tentatively moved his hand into her lap. Without raising her skirt, through the fabric very gently, he caressed her. "That's nice," Maria said softly. "Don't stop." It was as if the whole world were being transformed, as if she herself were being transformed in a fire that was not painful, but increasingly, steadily, inexorably. "Oh God, don't stop," she repeated. His face was magnified in every detail, as if she had put belladonna in her eyes for the opera. It was more real than flesh, solid as a statue, mask-like. "Don't stop." "Yes, darling, darling," he murmured. He kissed her neck, her ears. Gradually, with the left hand, he raised her skirt. As he got his right hand into her pantaloons, she felt as if the stars were descending into the coach, as if all life was light. "Oh, my God," she said. He knew what he was doing. He had found the exact place. She twisted her head, kissing him passionately on the lips, moaning. There were 2 fingers inside her now, then 3. She could not hold the kiss. She was breathing spasmodically. "God, God, God," she cried out. "God!" The whole world went away. She was lost in endless luminous waters, undulating through wave after wave of dilation. "Did you?" he asked, kissing her cheeks. "Yes, yes." "Oh, cara mio, am I terrible? Do you think the coachman heard me?" It wouldn't be the first honeymoon coach in which he's heard that kind of invocation of the deity, Sir John said, smiling. She laughed nervously. "I've disgraced myself. I couldn't even wait until we got to the villa. Coachmen must hear such things all the time, if they hear anything above the noise of the horse's hooves." Maria kissed him again. "Now you know it's true, what they say about passionate southern women. You do think you're wicked, don't you?" "Not really, but we are trained always to be ashamed, to be afraid, It is hard to believe I am married and it is not a sin. Silly. They kissed. She moved her hand into his lap. No, he whispered. You are afraid of shocking the coachman now. If he heard my moans, he can listen to yours, darling. No, it's different for a man. I am burning too, but the result, if you continue, it will be very visible to the servants when we meet them in the front hall of the villa. Oh, you poor darling. I have found, Sir John said, that reciting the multiplication table can calm me down until relief is in sight. 2 times 2 is 4. 2 times 3 is 6. They recited the multiplication table for a while. Passing by a palazzo, Maria suddenly saw Sigismundo Cellini out the window, weaving around in a drunken stupor, being held up by an old man. He shouted something she couldn't hear. Despicable man, she thought. He haunts me even on the happiest day of my life. She started kissing Sir John again and gradually nerved herself to move his hand back into her lap. If it won't get you too excited, she whispered. It won't. I love you so much. After a few minutes, she said, Darling, it's even better than the first time. Slower, please, darling. Slow, slow. Kiss me. After a while, she remembered to repeat, Don't get too excited. Then she said, God, and caro mio. And then she was limp in his arms again, lost in undulating light. They decided to recite the multiplication table some more. Then Maria said, No wonder poets call it the little death. I really felt myself going somewhere the second time, just as death must feel. But so sweet, so sweet. Darling, what is the name for it? Spending, in proper speech. The lower classes say, coming. Oh, when we get to the villa, we will spend and spend like millionaires. Men are different that way. I will not spend as much as you. How many women have you? No, forget that. I don't want to know. I will be jealous of them. You're the one I married. You're the one for the rest of my life. When they arrived at the villa, there was only one servant, an aged caretaker with a drooping white mustache, who kept grinning and grinning as he carried in their luggage. Nobody grins more than a happy Neapolitan, Sir John thought, just as nobody is sadder than a melancholy Neapolitan, and nobody is more furious than an angry Neapolitan. We English must seem like automatons to them. When they were alone in the room, Maria immediately began fondling Sir John. Darling, he said, wait, darling, just wait, darling, oh God, darling, just let me get my trousers off. You gave me such pleasure in the carriage. Darling, just let me. He got his trousers off clumsily. Caro mio, he said, kissing his neck, I hope this makes you feel the way I felt in the coach. Oh God, yes. Darling, caro mio, sweet man. Jesus, look in my eyes, see what you are doing to me. She looked into his eyes and watched them grow more and more glazed. At the final moment, he involuntarily closed them, and then she felt the warm stickiness on her hand. Darling, she said, let me sit down. They sat on the bed and kissed. What a lovely place, Sir John said, looking out the window at the trees' black silhouettes in the dark. I could stay here forever. We have enough money. Stay here and spend like millionaires, as you said. Never go back into that crazy, violent world. God, I'm happy. I think I enjoyed making you spend as much as I enjoyed spending myself, Maria whispered. They kissed again. Listen, he said softly. I have not been entirely chaste, but the others, that was just necessity. God made men that way. He did not invent celibacy. The churches did. It is impossible to be a male and not spend occasionally. If you resist it, it happens anyway in your sleep. I know, caro mio. It happened to me once in a dream. It happens to women, too? It only happened once. Maria was becoming embarrassed. She did not want to remember that she had been dreaming of Sigismundo Cellini at the time. It can happen to a young man as often as once a week, Sir John said, if he tries to be chaste, as the churches call it. The whole Christian world is a conspiracy to keep us from understanding that aspect of ourselves and of one another. We must break the conspiracy, he said fiercely. We must be able to understand each other in that aspect, too. He remembered the tombstone that boasted of serving liberty. Swift had done that by speaking honestly despite prudes and censors. Yes, what is it called, what you did to me in the carriage and I just did to you? Masturbation. If I were to do it myself, that would be masturbation. Those are the terms of doctors. What do ordinary people say? Frigging. I've heard that word, but I never knew what it meant. Some girls did it to each other at school. When girls do it together, Sir John said carefully, it is called tribidism. When boys do it together, it is called sodomy. Both are considered terrible vices, and one should not even admit in public that one knows such practices exist. Boys do it with each other? Maria laughed. That must look funny. I would imagine that it does, Sir John said, remembering not to stare too fixedly into her eyes. That was the sign of an amateur liar. What is the name for the consummation? People do not say sexual intercourse in private, I'm sure. It is called fucking in my language. That is a lovely word. I will enjoy fucking with you, my darling, even more than I enjoyed frigging you and being frigged by you. Now you're showing off your boldness. I beg your pardon, sir. I will enjoy having sexual intercourse with you. I like the other word better. You like to hear me say fucking? Very much. Somehow I knew you would like that. Maria kissed him again. You will be very gentle the first time because of the membrane? I will have to be, Sir John said, smiling. Men do not recover from spending as rapidly as women do. Oh, how long will it be before we can fuck? That depends. Before we experiment upon my rate of recovery, I suggest that we share a warm bath that is most relaxing and often stimulating. Did you hear that from all those other women? I bet you learned it from some shameless Frenchwoman. Actually, he said, bathing is the national obsession of my country. We believe in taking a bath before any activity, and usually afterward, too. You didn't answer my question. You do not really want me to talk about other women. No, not really. I was teasing. They kissed again. Well, he said, into the tub. Shall we be naked with the lights on? We can bathe in the dark if you are shy about that. I am shy, Maria said, but it is exciting, too. Remind me that we are married. We are very, very, very married, Katamia. We will leave the candles on. Even when we fuck? Yes, darling, even when we fuck. You may go behind the screen to disrobe, he said, and I will heat the water. No, Maria said boldly, I would like you to undress me, darling. Sir John had the usual problems with buttons and hooks, but eventually Maria was nude. You are as lovely as a painting by Titian, he said. And you, I think, are recovering. Yes, he said. Obvious, isn't it? What is it called? My cock. Oh, how nice. She took it in her hand again. Babcock's lovely cock, she said. Oh, God, he said. Say that again. Babcock's lovely cock. Christ, he said. I feel as randy as a stallion. And what is this called? Your cooney. It is almost Italian or Latin. Oh, let us heat the tub quickly. Wait, Sir John said. He knelt and kissed her bush. Oh, God, she said, embarrassed, that is better than your hand. But please stop. It cannot be nice for you.
It is very nice.
Please stop. It is wonderful, but it must be a terrible sin.
Not for married people. But he stopped.
I love you, he said, standing to look into her eyes. It's just another way of saying I love you. Make the tub. She was flushed and confused. Sir John heated the water and poured it into the iron tub.
Could you stand some more champagne after this afternoon? He asked.
I could drink a gallon.
You only think you could. He poured two glasses.
Let us take them into the tub.
Maria was pouring perfumes and bubbling agents into the tub. Bending forward, she reminded him of a Greek statue of Aphrodite he had once seen. They climbed into the tub.
To eternal love, Sir John said, raising his glass.
To eternal love, Maria answered. They clinked their glasses and drank.
I wish, Sir John said, that we had brought along a string quartet riding on top of the carriage.
We could have them playing outside the window. Vivaldi, I should think.
We don't need them, Maria said. The music is in my heart.
Darling.
Caro mio.
They kissed, almost spilling their glasses.
If we had that R in English, Sir John said thoughtfully, we'd have better poets.
It is like prayer, Maria said. Mother Ursula told me that once, and now I understand.
What is that?
It is my hand.
Much as I suspected, and what are you doing?
I am frigging you, frigging your lovely cock.
I surmised that something of the sort was transpiring.
You are shameless.
Yes, and you are enjoying it.
Very much.
But I must warn you, darling, about the male anatomy. I should not spend again, otherwise we will perhaps not be able to consummate tonight at all.
So, we can fuck tomorrow night, or tomorrow morning.
Would that not be heavenly, to fuck in the dawn, when the birds start to sing?
Can you wait that long? You seem to know many other amusements, my love.
I was so worried, Sir John said. I have never made love with a virgin before.
As for that, Maria said, I am still a virgin. Is that not remarkable after all the pleasures we have had already?
Oh, God, he gasped.
Are you?
Very close.
Good.
In India, Sir John said, I had an uncle who served there. Sometimes they do not consummate for a week or more after the wedding. They just do this and other pleasures. So the discomfort of the membrane does not happen until the bride knows all the pleasures. Oh, God!
Did you spend again?
Oh, Jesus, Nelly, yes.
I thought so. You looked like a tortured god, but it was not suffering.
No, it was not suffering. Let us get into bed with some more champagne. He poured more champagne. They climbed beneath the warm quilts.
To eternal love, he said.
To eternal love, she replied. They drank and put the glasses on the table. The whole world, Sir John said, is mad. Europe is one huge home for the feeble-minded, and the Orient is no better, from what I've heard. What fools we all are. Life can be so beautiful, and we make it so wretched for one another.
We will make a world of our own, and we will always have that when the outer world becomes too terrible.
I have been so lonely.
With all those other women?
There weren't that many, really.
They held each other. Sir John began to kiss her right breast. Oh, heaven, she said after a while, I can feel that in my cooney.
I know. Wasn't God clever in the way he designed our bodies?
Darling, put your hand there again.
I can do better than that.
He shifted his mouth southward. That is so sweet, she said after a moment, but not too much. I don't want to spend that way.
I want you to.
Oh, God, I love it, but I'm still afraid it is not really nice for you.
It is better than nice.
It is like a prayer. As your mother Ursula would say. Oh, caro mio. Oh, I'm so ashamed. Don't stop. I'm so ashamed. Are you sure you don't mind? Oh, God, I don't care. I think I will die of this, and I don't care. I am afraid to move. I'm afraid it will be ugly for you.
It is not ugly. I adore you.
Oh, God, I'm going crazy. I'm dying. Even in the carriage was not like this.
She had both hands on his head and was clutching spasmodically.
It is like the healing power all over me. Oh, God, I'm so ashamed, and I love you so much, and I'm dying. Oh, God, 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 God.
He held her tenderly, feeling entirely safe from the world and its madness.
I didn't really spend before, she said. I just thought I did.
Her head was on his breast, and her eyes were closed.
I have never felt so close to God. Is that silly?
No, it isn't silly at all.
But then she began to drowse, and in only a few minutes she was sound asleep. Sir John stared at the ceiling.
Eternal love, he quoted to himself.
That's a myth invented by the poets. I will make the myth come true. I will be good enough to deserve her. And then he realized that he was drowsing too. He awoke to the sound of pounding on the door, the caretaker.
What was the matter with the man?
You just do not come pounding on the door of a honeymoon's couple so early in the morning. But then Sir John realized that a great deal of sunlight was pouring through the window. It was not early at all. He and Maria had slept quite late.
"What is it?" he grumbled.
"Please, Signor, terrible news." Sir John got into his robe and, making sure that Maria was well covered, went to the door. He opened it a small crack. The caretaker looked like a rat in the middle of the melancholy process of gnawing his own leg off to escape a trap.
"Nobody looks unhappier than a sad Neapolitan," Sir John remembered thinking the night before.
"What is it?"
he asked anxiously.
"I'm sorry, Signor. The Count, he wants you both back in Napoli. It is very bad."
Sir John opened the door and stepped out into the hall.
"Do we have to tell the Signora?
Is it that bad?"
The old man had eyes like a spaniel mourning its master. He told the story in broken, half-coherent sentences.
"Damn. Is he dead, then?"
"Not yet, but it is very grievous, the wound. I will break the news to the Signora. Tell them to get the carriage ready."
Sir John stepped back into the bedroom and looked at Maria's lovely face, calm and serene in her sleep. "There is no safe place where you can wrap yourself in love and get away from the madness of the world," he thought. He touched her shoulder.
"Darling."
Her eyes opened.
"Caro mio,"
she said softly. Then she recognized the expression on his face.
"What happened?"
He sat down on the bed, held her.
"Darling, I have sad news."
"It is serious," she said. "I can tell." He told her, hating the ugliness of the words coming out of his mouth.
"We will have to go back to Napoli," she said.
"Of course."
Then she began to weep, and he held her for a long time before they got dressed and went down, in grim silence, to the carriage and the long trip back to Napoli. It had started to rain. When Sigismundo Cellini left the cathedral, he walked through the market, not noticing any of the noise or the bright colors, and walked on down to the waterfront, feeling very little and thinking not at all. When he stood looking at the bay, he thought, "I could jump in. End it all at once. Then somebody will rage against me as I raged against Tony that night when I dived for him again and again." It was not as if three souls were coming apart in civil war, he realized. The Rosicrucians have it a bit too pat there. It is more like gears turning. I call this gear the vegetative soul, and that gear the animal soul, and the next gear the human soul. But it is all just wheels and mechanical reactions. If I'm going to jump, it is not that I decide on death, but that the machine has been set to plunge into the sea. "It is terrible what is happening in my living room," Uncle Pietro had said when they were torturing Peppino. "This night will curse us all." The machine did not feel anything. It just walked toward the bay, blindly. "The truth," Sigismundo thought, "is that I do not feel anything because I am afraid to feel what is happening. That is why the machine walks without knowing where it goes." "You will come to us in the end," Peppino had said. Selfishness, vanity, jealousy, rage, those were the vices that had to be conquered before the fourth soul could crystallize. And so you tried to conquer them, and you might even think you were succeeding, if the people were not stabbing your uncle in church, if Rossi were not filling you with diabolical drugs, if the world gave you a few years without murder and horror, sitting down at the table every time you ate. You could practice the invocation of the four archangels and try to find the balance point, the inner sun, from which they were projected, and you could think the fourth soul spoke more and more often, not just in music, but everywhere. You could think you were on your way to superhumanity, to the Rose Cross degree. And then, just because a woman loved somebody else, you found that all the animal passions were still there. Everybody said the Englishmen were the worst lovers in Europe. Imagine Maria married to a cold, stiff, self-righteous, hypocritical Englishman. She was getting just what she deserved. Damn her. Sigismundo was back in the market. "Best silk you ever saw, right from Constantinople. Lowest prices you ever heard of." That was strange. He did not remember walking away from the bay. This was what happened when your rage was so intense that you could not allow yourself to feel it. He had been working on his autokinetan again the last month. Great things were being done in chemistry. Sigismundo was convinced there was a way to power the autokinetan when the right chemicals were found. That is probably as crazy as my music. He entered the Osteria Pompeii. The reason God made grapes was so that men could discover wine and escape from the misery of being human for a while. The reason mules are so sad is that they have never found a way to escape from the misery of being mules. See, he thought, I've already found one way in which I'm better off than a mule. After the third glass of Burgundy, he began to cheer up some more. It was quite funny, actually. Pour in certain chemicals, and the machine begins to malfunction. But the malfunction is amusing. I can pound on the table and tell everybody what donkeys and cattle they are, and the bartender will just stop serving me. They will not hold it against me because I am drunk. Glorious freedom. He drank some more wine, and finally he was able to feel something again. He would like to kill her. He imagined himself standing on the cathedral steps, rushing forward suddenly in the crowd, jabbing the dagger into her again and again. Blood on the white gown, horror on every face. Who did it? Sigismundo Cellini, the one who wrote the crazy music. It would be the one act that would truly, radically make a difference. It would declare his allegiance to his true father, Peppino the Revengeful, and to Peppino's god, Lucifer the Rebel. Lovely. What marvelous fantasies you have, he told himself. You wanted to be a saint of the Rose Cross, now you want to be a devil. Always the extremist, is that it? Have some more wine, he decided. It will pass. Tomorrow I will do the invocation of the four archangels again, and I will feel a light in the center, the inner sun, and I will not be a raging brute then. I will know I was a damned fool today. But what of it? Everybody has the right to be a damned fool one day, occasionally. Bad luck and too much wine. That was what Elpenor had answered when Odysseus asked how he had arrived in hell so fast. Don't think about that. Today is your day to howl and rage and be an animal. One day only. You have a right to one day. Was I serious about throwing myself into the bay? I can't remember. I don't know what I was thinking then. Have some more wine. Tana before you, Orpheus behind you, Aradia at your right side, Lucifer at your left side. No, no, no. He would not let Peppino rise from the grave and take over his soul. He would not be drawn into the satanic web of revenge and black magic. I think, he decided, the best thing to do is go home and sleep it off before I get myself into real trouble. I hear the north wind rising. I haven't done anything really stupid in months and months. The goblins are calling me. Yes, definitely. Time to go home and sleep it off. Sigismundo paid his bill, noticing the innkeeper's worried expression. He's afraid I'll collapse on the street and get robbed. Or I'll go to sleep in an alley and wake up with pneumonia. Well, I'm not really that drunk, I hope. But ever since rising to pay the bill, Sigismundo had felt somewhat dizzy and lightheaded. He hadn't noticed those symptoms while he was just sitting and drinking. He staggered to the door. Damn it, I don't have to lurch about like this. If I concentrate, I can still walk straight. No sense in letting all Napoli know I'm drunk. He hit both sides of the doorframe going through. Lovely son you have, Mama Celine. Writes the most bizarre music this side of China, invents machines that won't work, and now he's a public drunkard, staggering around like a blind horse. Contemplates suicide and murder in a single afternoon, too. Don't feel bad about it, though. Comes from his father's side of the family. And then, stumbling into the street, Sigismundo came face to face with Carlo Maldonado. My sweet Jesus, he thought, they do have the biggest noses in Napoli. No wonder the Count is nicknamed Cirino. Hi there, Banana Nose, Sigismundo said, smiling happily. Carlo Maldonado was not exactly sober himself. He had been drinking champagne all afternoon at his sister's wedding reception. What did you call me? He asked. You heard me, Sigismundo said with a drunken leer. If I had a nose like that, I'd go around on all fours so people would mistake me for a rhinoceros and not laugh. Carlo remembered the last time he had almost gotten into a duel with Sigismundo. He'd been a child then, but now he was 17, he was not going to get into an unnecessary fight. There were other ways to protect honor.
"You are drunk," Carlo said cheerfully, "and therefore not responsible for your bad manners. Go home and sober up before you make a spectacle of yourself."
He walked past.
"That was smart," one of the Portinari boys said, emerging out of the dusk. "That Cellini is a demon with a sword."
"I wasn't afraid," Carlo said quickly. "It is foolish to get into a fight with a drunk."
"Running away, are you?" Sigismundo shouted. "Just what I thought. That isn't the profile of a man, it's the profile of a dog."
Carlo turned. "You are a drunken fool, and I will ignore your childish behavior." He walked on, not too quickly. "I will not appear a coward in public," he thought, "but I will not let him bait me. I will be aloof and treat him as a child." Then Sigismundo was beside him again.
"Hey," Sigismundo said, weaving a bit.
"The hell you calling a fool? Elephant nose?"
Carlo thought, "You must not, ever, appear to be a coward in public. You are ruined if that happens. But it is stupid to get into a fight over nothing. His family has had much misfortune, and he is drunk."
He spoke softly, trying not to attract more of a crowd. "There have been great offers to make peace between our families. Do not ruin it because you drank too much. Go home and sleep it off."
"I knew you were yellow," Sigismundo said.
"It is pitiful," Carlo thought. "He is so blind drunk that a baby could knock him over with one finger."
"You will fall down in the gutter soon," he said. "Go home and sober up, I tell you."
Carlo walked on with dignity. "I'm handling this very well," he thought. "Just don't walk too fast now. I must not appear to be running away," as he called it. But a crowd was beginning to follow them. Sigismundo, like all drunks, was noisier than he realized.
"Well, who does want to fight?" Sigismundo roared, looking around blearily.
Old man Orsini emerged out of the dusk.
"You are crazy drunk," he said softly, taking Sigismundo's arm. "It is best that you let me take you home.
Already, Carlo would be justified in challenging you to a duel." Sigismundo was confused. He could not attack an old man. He began to realize that he was behaving abominably.
"I drank too much the wine," he said. "I'm not this sort of person."
"Yes, yes," Orsini said kindly. "But now you will come home, please."
"Thank you," Sigismundo said, weaving again. "I am no good. I have a devil in me, and this world is not our home, I think."
And then everybody heard it at once, coming from the distance, moving faster and faster. It wasn't thunder, they all realized suddenly. It was horses galloping. Orsini dragged Sigismundo out of the street, and the others scattered into arches and alleys simultaneously. It burst out of the dusk and night dew all at once, an enormous gold-decorated carriage. And as it passed, all saw the Maldonado coat of arms on the door. Like fading thunder, it disappeared into the twilight as abruptly as it had come. Suddenly, there was silence.
Moira, a knot. The fates, knitting and cackling, knitting and cackling.
"Carlo," Sigismundo screamed into the murk. "There goes your sister. The Englishman will be ramming it into her all night long. He'll shove it up her arse, too. The English love that."
Old man Orsini sighed loudly and began dragging Sigismundo rapidly uphill. But Carlo appeared beside them, running.
"You wouldn't shut up, would you?" he panted. "You stupid bastard. You...
All right. You want a duel? You shall have a duel."
"He is drunk," Orsini started to say.
"You heard what he said," Carlo panted. "Everybody in the goddamn palazzo heard him. It is my family honor that has been besmirched."
"I'll kill you," Sigismundo said. "It is destiny. You don't have a chance."
Tonone had recently told him that he was now a master of the sword and could learn no more short of real combat.
"You are the one who doesn't have a chance, you foul-mouthed imbecile," Carlo said bitterly.
"I am the offended party. I choose the weapons."
Sigismundo began to see with a degree of lucidity again.
"What weapons?" he asked, knowing the answer.
"Pistols," Carlo said, "in the field behind the botanical garden, at dawn."
He's the best pistol shot in Napoli, Sigismundo thought, and I'll have a hangover.
Bad luck and too much wine, Elpenor said.
When they arrived at the Celline household, Sigismundo left Orsini at the gate. I can walk to my room unaided, he said with an attempt at dignity. If the family learned about this business, he knew, the duel could still be avoided. Uncle Pietro, the master of negotiation, would see Count Maldonado, even in the middle of the night, even with the Count himself probably somewhat drunk from the wedding reception. Something could be worked out. It was possible. Only a dozen or so men had been in the palazzo and heard the challenge, and, since dueling was illegal, they would not be talking about it, yet. So it might be announced that Sigismundo Celline had received an appointment to teach music theory at the University of Paris. With Uncle Pietro's contacts, such an appointment might even be the truth before Sigismundo was further north than Milano. Carlo would eventually agree, if the Count insisted on it, that such an exile was sufficient punishment. Pietro could negotiate something like that. But the men who had been in the palazzo would know, and eventually they would talk. That Celline fellow who wrote the terrible music, remember? I know why he really left town. I was there when it happened. He was as foul-mouthed as a Corsican. Yes, and when he forced Carlo Maldonado to challenge him, what did he do? Turned tail and ran like a coward. Sigismundo collapsed on his bed, exhausted and already beginning to feel the hangover. They say he's still hiding out in Paris, afraid to come back. Well, how can he come back, a man who's marked as a coward? The duel could be negotiated away. Uncle Pietro was the man who could sell mud during a rainstorm. But the rumors afterward, they were non-negotiable. Nothing would stop the rumors. Turned tail and ran like a coward.
Christ, Sigismundo thought, it feels as if my head had the drum section of the teatro rehearsing inside it.
Everybody has the right to be a damned fool for one day, I told myself, but I forgot that the consequences can last more than one day, can last for the rest of your life.
Why not let Uncle Pietro negotiate the duel away, start a whole new life in Paris, or Oxford, or wherever they send the cases too crazy for Napoli? Does it matter what people in Napoli say if I'm not in Napoli? Does it really make sense to go out there in the dawn, with my head splitting and my hand unsteady, and get myself killed?
There was no use thinking that way. It carried no conviction. Because I was a Neapolitan before I was a Mason, before I was a musician even, before anything. And a Neapolitan does not run away from a fight. That is because we have been conquered so often, Uncle Pietro says. A conquered people develops its own kind of pride.
Sigismundo suddenly wanted water. He wanted to drink a gallon of it and pour another gallon over his head, but he remained on the bed. He would wait a while before attempting to go down the stairs to the well. Coming up had been enough of a challenge. He wondered how many duels had been fought by drunken participants. A great many, probably. Outside the damnable books of romance, sober men do not get themselves into this kind of mess. As a matter of fact, Carlo seemed a bit unsteady himself. He had probably been drinking at the wedding reception.
Glorious! The dawn rising on the beautiful botanical garden and two drunks staggering around, trying to see clearly enough to shoot each other.
This is a comedy, Sigismundo decided, except that one of us, or maybe both of us, will be dead when it is over. And I never learned anything about guns, because I dislike them. There is a lesson there. When you hate something, study it, don't ignore it, because it might come into your life anyway.
Bad luck and too much wine. Even Homer knew that was the quickest way to hell. And this is the third time, like my initiations. First a joke, then a horror, then the moment of truth.
Sigismundo finally managed to navigate the staircase back to the garden. I am not so drunk anymore, he thought. I was never once in danger of missing a step and falling. I just have to do everything very slowly for a while.
Once is chance, he thought. Twice is coincidence. Three times is destiny.
Which is just another name for our bad habits, Uncle Pietro said. He hauled up a bucket from the well and poured it over his head. Christ, that was a shock. But it was necessary. He hauled another bucket and poured it on himself, remembering his baptism,
his Masonic raising, his vision of death by water on the English Channel. 333. Terza rima. I'm an extra canto tacked into the inferno 4 centuries late. He hauled up a third bucket and drank a great deal, then went to the Jakes to urinate. Nobody buys wine, they just rent it. That was one of Uncle Pietro's favorite jokes. This night will curse us all. He slipped once, going back up the stairs. Let that be a warning. You are going to have to work on sobering yourself. It will be up and down the stairs for a long time, drinking and urinating until you are purged. Sigismundo sat on the bed, looking at his clavicembalo, his books, his familiar room that he might never see again if he died at dawn. I don't want to kill him. I don't want to kill anybody. How do we get ourselves into such messes? Sigismundo breathed deeply. There was only one course of action now. He would have to use everything he had learned of the craft to activate the fourth soul and rise above this idiocy that the animal soul had landed him in. Following Abraham Orfali's instructions, Sigismundo concentrated on his feet, imagining each muscle relaxing, visualizing white light. Gradually, he moved the relaxing light into his calves, his knees, his thighs, into the belly and chest, up from the hands, through the arms, to the shoulders, into the head. Step by step, he tried to relax each face muscle. He was then seeing himself, not as a physical body, but as a lattice of pure light. Then he began all over. It never works the first time, Abraham said. There is always more tension. Start over and do each step a second time. Sigismundo worked his way up from his feet to his head again. He held the vision of pure light for nearly a minute, remembering the arm movements of his first degree initiation. LVX. Light was the secret, the first matter of the alchemists. God's first commandment was not, let there be matter, but let there be light. He was still hungover, but definitely feeling better. Time for another perilous voyage on the spiral staircase. He did not slip or stagger once as he found the well and drank, found the Jakes and urinated, ascended the stairs once more. He sat on the bed, closed his eyes, and relaxed each muscle again, working upward from the feet to the head. When he was feeling himself as weightless light again, he summoned the 4 archangels. Soon he had them before him in full vivid detail. Raphael in his blue robes, Michael in his red, Gabriel in gold, Ariel in green. Now the hard part began. Without concentrating on the 4 guardians, he tried to keep them still present, and he began the middle pillar meditation. The first step was to visualize a white light, about the size of a large melon, floating in the air above his head. Everything else had to be ignored, including the fact that he might be dead in the morning. The white light had to be in perfect focus until consciousness moved from the pillar of luminosity that had been his body to the sphere of luminosity above it. Sigismundo then chanted aloud, Ahi, Ahi, Ahi. Then he continued the chant silently in his mind only. The problem was to keep the sphere of light in focus, remember the 4 angels at the 4 quarters, and still sink almost totally into the chant of Ahi. That meant I am, and was the most secret name of God, revealed to Moses. After several minutes, Sigismundo was exhausted, and had not even achieved as much success as he had in his first attempts 3 years ago. There is no substitute for hard work every day, Abraham said, or if there is, let me know as soon as you discover it. Sigismundo had not worked hard on this exercise every day as he should have. Music and mathematics were more immediately rewarding. He went back down the stairs and drank more water. When he returned to the bed, he began again. He was a pillar of light. The angels were in focus. The light above his head was brighter and brighter and brighter. Ahi, ahi, ahi. Sigismundo's scalp began to tingle. That was a symptom of success, Abraham said. He concentrated and relaxed at once, trying not to try, trying to let it happen. There was another tingling in his spine. The light descended 1,000 times brighter than when he had raised it. He was hardly there at all. The symptoms of hangover were gone. Now the problem was to hold on to that state and not relapse. Next, very carefully, the light was centered in the heart. It had to be golden light, not white, in this stage. The golden light in the chest and the white light above his head interacted. Energy pulsed through him, up and down, up and down. Sigismundo chanted, "Ayo, ayo, ayo," a name of God so secret it wasn't even in the Bible and was known only to the FRC. After 15 minutes, Sigismundo's chest was warm and tingling. He felt that the plants in the garden were enjoying this and wanted him to continue, and he was aware that space was not really Euclidean. Everything went out of focus, and Sigismundo was exhausted. He lay back on the bed and rested, and gradually he relaxed his feet again, his legs, his torso, his arms, his face, and then he began with the lights above his head and brought himself back to the point where he had failed. Sigismundo kept the white light in focus above his head and the gold light in his heart, and added a pink light around his genitalia. He chanted, "Ararita, ararita, ararita," a word of power created by taking the initials of a Hebrew sentence that meant, "One in his origin, one in his permutations, one in his essence." Ararita, ararita, ararita. I deserve to die in this duel. I brought it on myself. The lights went out, and Sigismundo sank back on the bed again, exhausted. This night will curse us all. Sigismundo walked carefully down the stairs to the Jakes and urinated. He didn't need any more water, he decided. The purgation was proceeding well enough. Sigismundo relaxed and started all over one more time. Relax the feet, the legs, the belly, the light above the head. Ahi, ahi, ahi. The golden light in the heart. Ayo, ayo, ayo. The pink erotic light. Ararita, ararita, ararita. The theory was that if you could keep all three lights glowing simultaneously, the rose cross would form. Dante's love that moves the sun and other stars. And the center of consciousness would shift entirely out of the vegetative reflexes, entirely out of the animal emotion, entirely out of human conceptualizing, into the fourth soul, the I am, the only mind in the universe. But Peppino had believed there was another mind, an opposing mind, one that wanted to remake the universe, turn it into something better. Lucifer, the light bringer, the rebel. That other opposing mind was the devil, the church taught. It was not the devil, the Rose Cross Order taught. It did not exist at all. It was an illusion. There was only one mind. The three lights were in perfect focus. Nothing else existed. The lights united. Sigismundo was aware of himself breathing slowly and easily in his bedroom, in the Celline Villa, high on a hill in Napoli, on the continent of Europe, on the planet Earth, in the system of 9 planets circling the inner sun, in a vast turning spiral, in the womb, in the pink erotic waters, midway between existence and non-existence, in vast, labyrinthine silence. The light was far, far away at first, but it approached at a dazzling speed. He remembered Canto 1 of the Purgatorio, when Dante first sees that kind of light. "Kneel, kneel," Virgil had cried. "It is an angel of the Lord." The light overwhelmed him. He had an instant of pure horror, thinking it would destroy him. Then he didn't care if it destroyed him. He came apart as if his body was indeed made of the atoms of Epicurus and every atom was hurtling away from every other atom. There was no center, no one mind, no Sigismundo. There were 1 million Sigismundos, going in 1 million directions, living in all parts of space and time. All of Napoli flowed through Sigismundo. He flowed through all of Napoli. He was beyond Napoli, beyond the world, and it all came together. Quite suddenly, it was unity in infinite diversity. The one mind, the fourth soul, the I am. Infinite space, infinite stars, infinite play. Everything was wax and melting in the eternal fire that was not hell, but paradise. Animals, fish, plants, stars, lattices, energies, melting, flaming. In vast, labyrinthine silence. He was remembering being a snake, an insect, a tree. It was all going by too fast, and he had to find his body again. He was back in the body of Sigismundo Cellini, a male body, 20 years old, in the year 1770, in Europe. The fact is, he decided, I never went out of the body, and I never came back into it. Space and time having nothing to do with this at all. There are no words for what really happens. I was never in the body any more than a sonata is in the instrument. The Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters and gave them form. I am the Spirit of God who moves upon the waters, the fiery flux, and makes all the forms. I don't know what I'm thinking. The light was not a blinding flash any longer. That had been some sort of explosion or spasm in his brain. It was part of the chaos that the brain experienced when losing one set of circuits and reorganizing itself upon a new set of circuits. The light was a simple lucidity now. Nothing was overwhelmed by it, but everything was seen more clearly in this illumination. It was indeed I am, because it was nothing more complicated than his own mind purged of the habits and limits of a lifetime. Purged, too, of desire and fear, of vanity and shame, more like a mirror than a sun, reflective. And so he waited then, without anxiety and without impatience, listening to his soft breathing, lost in the vast labyrinthine silence, knowing his invulnerability. Having died 1,000,000 times, he knew that death didn't change anything. The universe had died 1,000,000 times in those few minutes, and it was back again, too. The habit of seeing everything but his thoughts as outside was only a mind construct, as Hume would say. He could see everything as inside or as outside or as both. It was most amusing, he decided, to hold the double perspective and see everything as both inside and outside simultaneously. A bird began to sing. The sound was louder than thunder. He realized that he had never completely heard a bird song before, because he had never been in the vast labyrinthine silence before. He listened, enthralled. The bird sang on, and he became the song. He flowed into the bird flowed into him. They were singing, they were not singing. There was only the song. More birds joined in. It seemed as if he could hear each one of them, all the way down the hill, all across Napoli, flowing into the worms, into the living earth itself. There was no Sigismundo again. He came back slowly, not rushing it this time, to the single focus. The sun was beginning to bleed into the darkness, and the sky was turning pink, light like a rose opening. Brother sun, sister moon, he thought. San Francesco was not being fanciful when he wrote that. Sigismundo took off his damp clothes, washed quickly, and dressed in his best outfit. By the time the sky was fully aglow, he was standing outside the gate on the street, waiting. And when the seconds arrived, he greeted them quietly, knowing his infinity, and smiled slightly, not bravely or boldly as he imagined himself smiling, but simply seeing it all with great amusement, since he had never seen clearly before, still lost in the vast silence like an empty cathedral at midnight. Everything left an echo. And as they walked toward the botanical garden, Sigismundo looked about him with awe, as Adam must have looked at Eden on the first morning, seeing every bush, every flower, every petal with that new vision, knowing his invulnerability. He could walk away from it all. He didn't even have to leave Napoli. He could stay right here, with the whole town calling him a coward, and that would not matter, since he was no longer Sigismundo Cellini, but the one mind, the only mind, temporarily playing at being Sigismundo Cellini. On the other hand, this duel was his destiny, and it did not really matter one way or the other. It was enough just to smell the dawn, the freshness of everything waking after night, and to notice the dew clinging to a rose petal. In the vast, labyrinthine silence, knowing his invulnerability, he did not care that Sigismundo Cellini was a damned fool a great deal of the time and might die for his latest foolishness. He did not care that Sigismundo Cellini was a very bright fellow at times and might make important contributions to music or to mechanics. The autokinetic was possible somehow, or to some field or other, if he ever got his head straightened out and decided what his real talent was. It was funny, in a sad way, that Sigismundo Cellini got drunk and acted like a brute and an idiot because he thought one woman was more important than the rest of the world. But that was the kind of idiocy to which Sigismundo was prone, like many other young males. He wondered what Maria was actually like. The phantom in his mind, the goddess he had created, was just the fifth soul trying to wake the fourth soul, Sechina, the embodied glory of God, which always takes a female form, as Abraham had taught him. Who was the actual Maria, the woman he had confused with this eternal presence? He knew less about her than about the continent of Antarctica. In a sense, he thought, I am still Sigismundo Cellini. I have to live out his life. That was sad and funny, since he knew Sigismundo Cellini was no more solid than a sonata. Being all mind forms, he could adopt that form, the Sigismundo form, again. But he could also walk away from it any time and watch it. The fourth soul is like being an actor on the stage, he thought, and also like being in the audience watching the whole drama and being the author himself. And now they were crossing the botanical garden and entering the field. Carlo and his seconds were waiting. Sigismundo suddenly felt a vast, unexpected wave of compassion. Carlo looked very nervous, even though he was the best pistol shot in Napoli. The poor boy, Sigismundo thought. He imagines that if Carlo Maldonado dies, he will cease to exist. The 4 seconds were conferring. They tossed a coin 3 times. It was decided that Portinari, the barber surgeon, would give the shout of fire at the appropriate time. Carlo was formally asked, as the offended party, if he would accept an apology. If he agreed, Sigismundo would then be asked to offer the apology. No, Carlo said, white-lipped. You all heard what he said about my sister. Another bird began to sing. Just one bird this time. Sigismundo did not recognize its call. Perhaps some voyager from the north on its way to Africa for the winter, and he was at one with it, as he was at one with all things, having become the inner sun, the single star, the source of every permutation of consciousness. He smiled again, knowing his invulnerability. So, when the pistol in the velvet-lined dueling case was handed to him, he took it without any emotion and examined it carefully. It required none of the art of the sword. You merely had to point correctly and fire quickly, and Newton's laws would do the rest. I will aim for the shoulder, Sigismundo decided. He is nervous and I am not, so I can shoot first. Then all this damned fool honor business will be satisfied. Old Portinari will have the bullet out of him in 10 minutes before blood poisoning or anything like that can happen. He walked his 10 paces with the serenity of a monk telling his beads on a rosary, and turned, cocking the hammer, waiting. Even at 20 paces he could see the sweat on Carlo's face. The strange northern bird sang again, one moment of pure music, like a trill by Scarlatti, suspended in eternity. Fire! Shouted Portinari. The knocking was interminable, like some idiot child who has just found a drum and pounds and bangs on it until you think you will go deaf. It went on and on, gradually dragging Pietro Malatesta out of his sleep. The servants, he muttered, God blast, why hasn't one of the servants answered it? But then he realized that the knocking had stopped. One of the servants had answered it. And now there was thudding steps on the stairway. I am an old man, he thought. I have had enough troubles to fill 3 novels and a grand opera. Let me sleep. But no, the steps had come to the bedroom door, and now there was a gentle rapping. What is it? He growled. I will absolutely and positively not get out of bed for anything less than a summons from the palace, he thought.
and I will politely tell them to wait until morning. I will not get dressed and go out unless it's the second coming of Christ accompanied by angels with trumpets. Pardon, Signor. Very bad news. I sell the damn stuff and know what it does to my customers. You would think I'd have enough sense at my age not to drink it myself. Oh, God, I think my head is full of goblins with meat cleavers. Pietro shuffled to the door. It was Paolo, the gardener. Naturally, his house was nearest the gate. He would be the first one wakened. Pardon, Signor. It is Signor Orsini. He must speak with you. Your nephew, Sigismundo, is fighting a duel in a few hours. I'll be right down, Pietro said. He groped his way to the washstand and poured the pitcher of water over his head. Sigismundo is special, he told himself. It is not his fault. The damned fool things he does. The power drives us mad until we learn to control it. I was a fool at his age, too. I must be calm. I must not rush at once to his house and kick his arse from here to Baghdad and back. What? Violetta mumbled, almost sitting up. Is nothing, he said. Sleep, beautiful woman. She said, settling back. I wonder if she really is still beautiful at her age, Pietro mused as he dressed. Or is that just one of the delusions I prefer not to get rid of? Of course I have to stop this idiot duel. At my age, in the middle of the night. I'll be 60 next December. Maybe the stars are right. Maybe Sigismundo is under protection until his destiny is achieved. Then I can just go back to bed and wait for the elephants in my head to stop dancing. No, that is a delusion I cannot afford. But by the time he had his boots on, he was thinking clearly again. Just another merry day with those fun-loving Malatestas, some casual slaughter before breakfast. At least the boy knows how to use a sword, thank God. When Pietro arrived in the living room, Orsini looked ghastly. Of course, Pietro thought. He's been up half the night worrying if it was proper to intervene. Thank you for coming here, Pietro said at once, making a mental note to send Orsini a case of wine the next day. Always reward the bringers of information, whether the news is good or bad. That was one of his basic rules. It guaranteed that he would know more news faster than anybody else in Napoli. Tell me whom my idiot nephew is planning to murder. Carlo Maldonado, Orsini said unhappily. But it is your nephew who is in danger. Oh? Pietro realized what that meant. Carlo was the offended party and picked the weapons? Yes. Pistols, of course. I am sorry to tell you this. Damn, Pietro grimaced. He's been fencing for 10 years now, so naturally he gets himself into a duel with pistols. Against a fellow who is said to be able to shoot the hind leg off a crab louse 20 yards, riding backward. Where? Behind the botanical garden at dawn. Pietro glanced at the clock on the mantel. 5:23. At this time of year, dawn was about a half hour away. Pietro seized Orsini's hand. Your kindness will be remembered, he said warmly. The Malatestas will always be your friends. He was already moving Orsini toward the door, grabbing his own cloak as he went. No time to get to see Count Maldonado, he was thinking. No time for anything but a mad dash to the botanical garden. No time for diplomacy or negotiations, no time for wheeling and dealing, no time for any of my tricks. All I can do is to try to be there before the shooting starts, and then? Then I improvise. He thanked Orsini several times more before they parted. Then he did not attempt to run. With a few gallons of champagne aboard and 59 years of tiredness in his bones, he knew he would just collapse of exhaustion. He walked rapidly, not letting his heart overtax itself, slowing once or twice when he heard himself panting. Kept a good pace, constantly scanning the east, watching for the first streaks of sunrise. He was doing the relaxing breath and visualizing the inner sun. There is no sense planning anything, since it all depends on when I arrive. I will just have to trust my instincts. There is only one mind. If I am empty enough, that mind will act through me. I may not have the power Abraham has,
but I have over 30 years of practice by now. Relax, be alert, and remember the 8 invisible aids. My habits will carry me through. Ex Dio nascimur, in Jesu morimur, per spiritum sanctum reviviscus mus. And then he saw a streak of rose on the horizon. Don't run, you are almost there. But the rose was turning into a huge fireball of orange. He hath given me power to run through a troop and leap over a wall, the psalmist said. He, the fourth soul, does not know space, time, or limits. Pietro Malatesta ran. Like a boy of 19, as if 40 years were removed in the twinkling of an eye, the psalmist's words repeating again and again in his head, he ran. Ran through the gate of the botanical garden, seeing the whole sky eaten by tangerine fire. Ran among the lilies and roses and cosmos and daffodils. Ran toward the field where he could now see the small group standing about. Ran faster as he recognized Sigismundo pacing out his 10 feet in one direction, and Carlo Maldonado pacing in the other direction. Ran and ran and ran, repeating, "He hath given me power to run through a troop and leap over a wall." He appeared racing across the field with the speed of a deer just as Portinari shouted, "Fire!" "Stop!" screamed Pietro. Everybody jumped as 2 shots rang out. Sigismundo heard the shout of "Stop!" and recognized the voice even before he involuntarily turned toward the source of that voice. And he jerked the trigger automatically, and then the whole universe exploded. He was thinking that the gun had a terrible kick to it before realizing, admitting, that he was hit, that the world was not being destroyed by fire, but that it was only his body contorting with pain. There seemed to be millions and millions of suns, just as Bruno said, and each sun was going out, one by one, as the cosmos plunged into deathly darkness and chaos. But that was only his body. It wasn't really the whole universe. It was like crossing the English Channel on the boat. The waters all cold and choppy, and he was falling off the boat into the cold waters. His whole body freezing, teeth chattering like the night he dived again and again for Antonio. And he was going down, 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 and then coming up, up, up as he realized that Portinari was probing his shoulder with a hot knife. Water and fire are one. Damn, Portinari said. It went right through you. Jesus, somebody check Pietro. My God, he's hit too, a voice shouted. I thought he just fainted from the exertion of running like that, Portinari's voice said, going away. Hell, it must have been the bullet that went through Sigismundo. Everybody has a right to be a damned fool for one day, Sigismundo thought. That's what I told myself, and now my uncle may be dying because of it. He didn't even think of Carlo yet. He was lying on his back in the field, in Napoli, not watching whole solar systems explode and die. He sat up. "Hey, you, don't try to move," Portinari's voice shouted. Sigismundo got to his feet. The field immediately tilted crazily to the left, and the sky started spinning, but he was able to stay erect. He felt like an afterbirth when the midwife wraps it in old rags and buries it in the backyard, but he stayed on his feet. Portinari was crouching over Uncle Pietro's body about 50 feet away. "Stay down," he shouted back at Sigismundo. "I can't take care of both of you at once." Sigismundo took a step and stumbled. Toward the one, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty. He fell. And the pain exploded all over him again. He was diving again, but there was no bottom to the bay, and Antonio was nowhere in the inky blackness. His teeth chattered, and sweat stung his eyes. Chills and fever. I'm dying, maybe. One of Carlo's seconds was leaning over him. "You'll start the bleeding again, you damned fool. I'll check your uncle for you. Stay down." "It's my fault," Sigismundo said. "I am a devil." Toward the one, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being, united with all those illuminated souls. He'd lurched to his feet again and promptly puked down the front of his shirt. He went on retching for what seemed like a long time,
while the grass and sky kept whirling around and around him. I'm not here, remember that. I'm the fourth soul, outside of all this, looking in. We do not stand on our legs, but on our will. He staggered forward, toward Uncle Pietro. Hold that idiot down, somebody yelled. This night will curse us all. I will return as millions. Moira, a knot. Sigismundo fell again, but he was closer to Uncle Pietro now. Rest a minute, he thought. Try to stop the chattering of the teeth so that I don't bite my tongue off. Visualize the light. Breathe. Now, try again. Sit on him, a voice shouted. He'll kill himself if he gets up again. He was sitting, not quite able to stand again quite yet. One of the seconds was looking down at him. How's Carlo? He asked. Not good. You shot him in the groin. Jesus, Sigismundo said. I aimed for his shoulder. He was on his feet again. Pain is nothing, he told himself. Only cowards stop when they feel pain. Take me there, he prayed. I can't do it alone. He walked, lurching wildly in all directions, stumbling toward the place where Portinari was working over Uncle Pietro. The smell of his own vomit on his shirt made him nauseated again, and the sky kept spinning in circles. Toward the one, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being, united with all those illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the teacher, the spirit of guidance. Take me there. There is only you. I am you. The flowers are you. Carlo is you. Take me there. He fell again, and the waves washed over him, taking him down, down, down into the well, into the cold waters. He was crawling over the red-hot coals of hell. The Dominicans were right, after all. He would spend infinite hours and infinite days in infinite torment for all his sins. He crawled onward, blinded by his sweat, seeking to regain his unity with the one mind, and the red-hot coals became sweet green grass again. Uncle Pietro turned his head and looked at him. At last, Pietro said. What? At last, free, damnable books. Then Pietro's eyes glazed, and the waves came up again, and Sigismundo went into freezing blackness. What a mess, Count Maldonado said. What a perfect, classic, Neapolitan mess. Sir John and the Count were sitting in the garden, and neither of them were quite ready to accept the relief that the doctor's words had brought. Your son will live, Sir John said. Just remember that. I know. I can hardly believe it. The way my Carlo looked when they brought him home, I thought he was a dead man. Maria was praying all the way back here in the coach. She is a good girl, and her prayers have power. We should all be grateful to Pietro Malatesta, Sir John said. If he hadn't shouted when he did, one of the bullets might have been fatal. He made them both jump, I gather. Pietro is the cleverest man in Napoli, the Count said. I suppose, yesterday, he realized that he was too late for cleverness, so he just made noise. Well, it was good enough. It saved my son's life, perhaps. Still, the nature of the wound. I can never forgive that. The doctor said he couldn't be sure, Sir John said. The bullet entered nearly an inch above the generative organ. Carlo is in no sense a eunuch. I know, Count said. Some men have been wounded there and still fathered children. But the doctor could not say for sure which tubes and arteries were destroyed. It is god-awful. Imagine yourself Carlo's age and imagining going to bed with a woman and wondering if you can still perform. It is unspeakable. I'd better not say. He can always become a monk, Sir John thought. Just be glad your son is alive, he repeated gently. The Count sighed, looking out over the hedges and flower beds. Such a beautiful day, he said, and I don't know if my son is a rooster or a capon. How long should I leave Maria with Carlo? Sir John asked. As long as she wants to stay by the bed. Her prayers are powerful, and I have seen men die of complications after doctors say they were recovering. Very well. In that case, Sir John said,
I think I shall stroll over to Via Capodimonte and pay respects to Pietro Malatesta.
Yes, both as a brother mason and a relative stranger, you are the perfect negotiator at this point.
That idiot boy, Sigismundo, must leave Napoli.
That is the condition. If this ever got to court, exile would be the least punishment. But assure Pietro of my continued esteem for him personally.
Of course, Sir John stood.
And if Maria does come down, tell her I'll be back in an hour. But midway on his walk, the depression came over him. I must not be superstitious, he thought. It is nonsense to regard this imbecile duel as an omen or anything of that sort. She loves me, and I love her. We can find that happy, safe space again. When we return to England, all this will be forgotten. I must not let myself think that the marriage coach was somehow turned into a hearse. Then he admitted that it was not the duel that was oppressing him. Three wounded, but none dead. It was almost a happy ending to what could have been a tragedy. His dark mood was caused by something he did not want to notice. A boy walking ahead of him on the street. A boy he did not want to stare at. A boy with the grace of an Athenian statue. After 3 days, the doctor said Sigismundo could take a walk any time he wished, as long as he didn't go too far or overexert himself. Sigismundo went straight to the ghetto and found Dr. Orfali's shop. As usual, the bell rang and old Abraham came from behind the curtain. Sigismundo again thought of a cuckoo clock. "You do not look bad for a boy with a hole through his shoulder," Abraham said. "It's healing. I even played the clavicembalo this morning. A little." "Come in the back, where we can sit," Abraham said. Sigismundo remembered his first visit to that room and the first glimpse of the four guardian angels. "So," Abraham said, sitting comfortably, "you have come here to be denounced, no? Hasn't Pietro chewed you out enough already? You need more?" Sigismundo waited. "It isn't that," Abraham said. "Oh, how stupid of me. You have found the fourth soul. You can tell just by looking at me?" "How big is it?" Sigismundo smiled. "How old is it?" Sigismundo laughed. "So, you went all the way. What do you want from me, then?" "It wasn't the way it's supposed to be. I had to get drunk and make a fool of myself and shout obscenities in public. I almost killed Carlo. I almost got my uncle killed, too, for that matter. I am a beautiful example of everything a mason should not be. I do not deserve the fourth soul." "Never say that," Abraham said, suddenly angry. "Everybody deserves it. You know that when you are in your right mind. I have been a bigger fool than ever, and have disgraced my family, and now I have to go into exile like a common criminal." "And you have lost the fourth soul already. I can see that, too. Don't worry. Once you have been there, you can always find your way back. It is easier the second time." "I may have emasculated Carlo," Sigismundo cried. "That puts me in some elite corps with Aunt Gina. We should change the company sign, Malatesta and Celline. Fine wines and gelding. We could get an exclusive contract, providing castrati for the Vatican choir. If we get any better, we could supply the guards for the Arab harems, too." "You did come here to be denounced." "No. All I have to do is think of Carlo's eyes, looking at me. That will denounce me for a lifetime. Listen. To find the fourth soul requires forgiveness. How many times have you heard me say that?" "That means forgiving yourself, too, even though that is the hardest of all and takes longest of all." "My ordinary mind," Sigismundo said wearily, "is so stupid." "So is mine, and the minds of the rats and the fish and trees. Only the one mind is lucid."
I know, Sigismundo said tiredly, "but
you think you are a disgrace to the craft. You think others are more worthy. You think it isn't fair that you have attained illumination and more worthy men haven't.
Forget all that. Remember the widow's son."
"It can happen even to fools like me," Sigismundo said, "because God's ways are inscrutable. Is that what you mean?"
Abraham laughed. It only happens to fools like you, he said. Or me, he added mischievously. And looking into the old man's eyes, Sigismundo suddenly saw a youth much like himself 60 years ago, getting into all sorts of follies. Sir John and Lady Babcock sailed for England on July 23, 1770. Sigismundo was inconspicuously lurking near the dock when the ship sailed. He had no illusions about Maria anymore. She was a total stranger. Whether they would have been compatible at all if matters had worked out differently was just another unsolved question. Whoever and whatever she was, he wished her well. Babcock was a true Mason and a true lover of liberty. He wished them both well. Seeing her depart was just a ritual act, completing his cure from the delusions he had had about her. Sigismundo himself left Napoli the following week. There were no legal problems. Count Maldonado and Uncle Pietro had paid the right bribes to the right people, and even though half of Napoli knew there had been another illegal duel behind the botanical garden, the police, officially, did not know it. Sigismundo was eager to start over somewhere else, and the University of Paris was said to have one of the best natural philosophy departments in the world. Electricity, on which the faculty there were particularly keen, might be part of the answer to some of his problems with the autokinetone. Uncle Pietro was uncharacteristically brief in his words of advice on parting. "Get yourself a mistress," he said bluntly. "Otherwise, you'll end up haunting those maisons and acquire a classic case of the French pox. Don't borrow from professional money lenders. Write to me if you're short. And for God Almighty's sake, never play cards with a Corsican." Once on the coach, Sigismundo woke from an erotic dream. Nobody was staring at him. The other passengers were all dozing. So he hadn't talked in his sleep, fortunately. Still, it was odd to be dreaming about Maria again. He had put that folly firmly behind him. Besides, she was the wife of a brother Mason now, and however many kinds of fool and scoundrel Sigismundo might be at times, he would certainly never break the Masonic trust by seducing a brother's wife. And she probably hated him for shooting her brother. And she was in another country. The dream was an obvious absurdity. He would never see Maria again. He was sure of it. When classes began at the University of Paris in the autumn of 1770, Sigismundo had found comfortable lodgings in the Rive Gauche and was enrolled in chemistry, music theory, advanced calculus, and physics. He had begun to discover a Paris that he had not explored on his first brief visit. Whenever he walked about in search of the mistress he knew he really needed in order to avoid the maison, he noticed how filthy the streets were. The worst parts of Napoli were small in comparison to the whole. The worst parts of Paris were most of Paris. Women, he learned, did not get out of the coaches at all if they could avoid it. The streets were so dirty that their skirts would be ruined in half a block. The newspapers printed every detail about the growing unrest in the British colonies of North America, so that everybody who could read knew that a mob had attacked British soldiers in New York City in January, and another mob had attacked another British platoon in Boston in March. It is as if, Sigismundo thought, they want everybody to know how a revolution starts, as if they look on what is taking place in America as a rehearsal. At the university, egalitarianism was not regarded as a radical notion by either students or professors. It was an inevitability, and the only question was, how soon? If I told them I am half peasant, Sigismundo thought, they would take me on tour as an exhibit proving that all men are born equal and only society determines their differences. And then on December 17th, sitting in an outdoor café, Sigismundo saw the Bavarian lawyer he had met in Abbeville at the time of the Labar atrocity. "Herr Zeusser," he called out at once. The obese Bavarian stopped and stared. "Signor Celine, n'est-ce pas?" he asked hesitantly. "Of course, it's been years." "Have a seat," Sigismundo said. "How long will you be staying?" Zeusser was as bland as ever. "I am now permanently in Paris," he said. "The Bavarian climate became, a bit uncomfortable for me." That was not a slip, Sigismundo realized.
"It is good to see you again," he said, holding out his hand. Their fingers probed and formed the grip. Sigismundo was not surprised. Zoicer's opinions would draw him to masonry eventually. Maybe he had been a fellow of the craft as far back as their meeting in Abbeville. "I am more or less permanently in Paris myself," Sigismundo said, "at least until I've learned what I want to learn at the university." "How long have you been here?" Zoicer said cordially. "More than 3 months." Zoicer lowered his voice. "Have you contacted a lodge yet?" "No. There are so many rival lodges in France these days, I'm not sure which one is closest to what we consider the true craft in Napoli." Sigismundo added pointedly, "I don't want to get associated with a gang of atheists." Zoicer nodded. "Atheism is a bit extreme," he said carefully. "Still, it's inevitable, for a while. An absolute church eventually produces an absolute opposition. But I think I know what would suit your principles. The Grand Orient Lodge of Egyptian Freemasonry. Is its goal the same as that of the Neapolitan lodges?" "I have never been in Napoli," Zoicer said. "But I have met other Neapolitan Masons, and I think I understand your principles. The Egyptian lodge will be most compatible. They too aim at expanding the mind to form higher selves. How do I contact them?" "I'll be glad to take you to a meeting. Actually, I've joined several lodges since I still travel a great deal. I think the conflicts that are developing among rival factions are dreadful, and, in my small way, I hope to be a force of mediation between them." "There are no accidents," Sigismundo said. "It is providential that we met today." "Greetings on all three points of the triangle," Zoicer quoted. They smiled. "Well," Sigismundo said, "tell me more about the Egyptian lodge." "The Grand Master is Philippe, Duke of Chartres. If succession falls the right way, he may be the next king, or the one after next. Can you imagine an illuminated monarch? It would be Plato's dream fulfilled." "Who else?" "I can assure you, most of the leading minds of the country, aside from the totally fanatic revolutionaries. We have one man who holds the 32nd degree, just below Chartres himself, called Count Cagliostro. He is the greatest healer I have ever encountered. Some say he performs actual miracles. Just sit with him 5 minutes and look into his strange violet eyes, and you will feel as if you have left this planet entirely and visited other worlds." "Cagliostro," Sigismundo exclaimed. "He is Italian too?" "Yes, now that I think of it. He even looks a bit like you, around the eyes. You will visit many lands and cross the ocean, but in the end you will come to us. I will be most interested to meet this Count Cagliostro," Sigismundo said. It began to snow. Just a few lonely flakes at first, then a flurry. Sigismundo and Zoicer moved their cups to an indoor table and watched as the white crystals took on the obvious character of an oncoming storm. The flakes came faster and thicker, and soon the street and the neighboring rooftops lay under a coating of purest white. The color of purity, Sigismundo thought, in both Catholicism and Masonry. The color that was all colors and yet no color really. Under the oncoming winds, Paris seemed to crouch. Waiting.